Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, hour number two of our show. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. This week is Cartoon Appreciation Week, so declared by the National Cartoonists Society, and gives us an opportunity to welcome back to the show here author, cartoon historian Robert Harvey. He's been with us before on a number of occasions. He is the author of a number of books that look at the history of cartoons and cartooning, including The Art of the Funnies, The Art of the Comic Book, Children of the Yellow Kid, which is all about the comic strips that appear in newspapers. He's written a book about Milt Caniff, who was the cartoon artist who created the strip Terry and the Pirates, and has written also some other books about individual artists. He has a website that's rcharvey.com, which has lots and lots of information there about cartoon art, classic and contemporary, more than you probably would ever want to know if you're a hardcore cartoon or comic fan. You would, I'm sure, enjoy it. He is an associate member of the National Cartoonist Society and of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists, and writes regularly for the Comics Journal, and has been, as I said, been with us here before, and it's always fun to have him here on the program. It's an opportunity for people to ask questions, make comments, to talk about this unique art. And all you have to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. We also do have that toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL or 9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So this, I think us talk show hosts ought to get together and have a talk show appreciation week. I guess if if you got a trade association, you can declare your own week.
But that's right.
I think that's okay. That's okay.
That's the main idea of having an association, is to declare national recognition weeks, I think.
So this, but this is a time that they have set aside to at least say, well, let's to try and encourage people to think about cartoons and talk about them and what it is that makes cartoons and cartooning special. And I think, as we have discussed before on this program, that there is something interesting about this form that takes drawings and words and puts them together in a way where you get something that's a little more than the sum of the parts. If you take the pieces apart, it's not quite the same as the thing that you get when everything all comes together and when it comes together in the best way that it can.
Right. It's not it's a static art, of course. The pictures don't move. Movies and animated cartoons bring pictures and words together in the same frame of reference, so to speak. But cartoons, comic strips, comic books, graphic novels are the only static form, printed form, in which words and pictures are blended to achieve, as I usually say, a meaning that neither words nor pictures alone without the other can achieve.
Yeah.
And you can find good examples of that in the daily newspaper, looking at the humorous comic strips, usually many times. The joke is not evident unless you are aware of both the pictures and the words. If you cover up the pictures with your hand and read just the speech balloons, very often they're not funny. Sometimes they are, and if they are, then you don't need the pictures, and then it's not quite as good a cartoon as it is otherwise.
Yeah. I was just thinking about the fact that, you know, for a while now, in the New Yorker magazine, famous for cartoons, they've had this feature on the back page where they print a cartoon without the punchline, and it's an opportunity for people who read the magazine, so you can make up your own joke, and you can send them into the magazine, and they pick the ones, three, I think, every time that they think are the best. And I think that shows you, first of all, the drawings without the punchline, sometimes they're not much at all. And it also shows you that it's not – doing that is not easy.
Right,
Making up a good punchline for a drawing is really a difficult thing.
Yeah, and this back page contest in the New Yorker is a perfect example of the sort of thing I would produce to illustrate how the words and pictures are dependent. Usually the drawing that they start with contains a visual incongruity, something that is inexplicable. And the caption that somebody is going to provide will explain that incongruity, that inexplicable something. So the caption is dependent on the picture, and the sense of the picture is dependent on the caption. It's a perfect blending of word and picture. It's a really remarkable example.
And is it? Do I have this right that sometimes, at least, the people who have drawn the cartoon and the people who end up making up the cap, it's not the same people. Somebody else might make up a caption for the drawing, or maybe not like the one that's supplied by the artist, and they may think, "Well, this will be better," and write up something else.
That used to be the case with the New Yorker more in the 20s and 30s and maybe 40s when the magazine was just getting going than it is now. I think now almost all the captions are supplied by the cartoonist. I think you get a better cartoon that way. Two of the most famous New Yorker stalwarts were James Thurber and E.B. White, and they shared an office. And their job was to tinker with the captions of cartoons that were submitted by cartoonists. Mm-hmm. And very often they would change the caption entirely, so it wasn't there at all. There's a very famous cartoon by Carl Rose. And as a mother and a daughter seated at a dinner table, and the mother is saying to the daughter, "Eat your dessert, dear, or eat your salad, or whatever it is." And the daughter is saying, "I say it's spinach, and I say it's to hell with it." And that caption was not the caption that Carl Rose started off with. He started out with something else, wound up in the hands of James Thurber and E.B. White, and they massaged it into a completely different cartoon. Mm-hmm. It's not done as much as it used to be.
Well, people can, if you get the New Yorker, you check that out. I'm sure people do. When we get the magazine, of course, the first thing we do is look at the cartoons. And even if you don't get the magazine, you could challenge yourself and come to understand just coming up with a good punchline for a good drawing is not an easy thing.
Right. It's kind of like thinking the caption for a single-panel cartoon, in effect, explains the picture. Without the caption, the picture is a puzzle. And so you read the caption, and the explanation dawns on you suddenly, and you are amused because of the ingenuity of this marriage of word and picture, because it surprises you.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all probably reasons for laughing.
Each artist is probably different, but how do they do that? Do most people have some kind of idea for a picture, or do they have some idea for a punchline, or do those things kind of evolve together?
Well, my contention is that cartoonists think in words and pictures simultaneously. That, of course, is a theoretical construct. I think it's true, but I think sometimes the words come first, but they may come only a fraction of an instant ahead of the picture, and the cartoonist realizes, oh, that's funny. Eldon Dedini, who used to draw, he died about 4 months ago, and he used to draw for both Playboy and The New Yorker. And he used to say that, or he said frequently, that he would start with a picture, just a picture that he wanted to draw. I mean, this is a wonderful picture to draw, so I'm going to draw this. And then he would just leave the thing lying around his studio for a while, and all of a sudden a caption would occur to him. Sometimes he'd be reading the newspaper or performing some other activity altogether, and he would take some piece of current slang or cant and just laminate it onto the bottom of that cartoon, and all of a sudden it was a funny cartoon.
Mm-hmm.
His way of generating ideas, he had sketchbooks, and the sketchbooks were filled with drawings, illustrations, things that he had clipped out of magazines, advertising illustrations, full-color drawings, pictures of Japanese print art and things like that, and he'd paste them right into the sketchbook, and then he might draw a little something on the facing page. And he would think, you know, well, I like this. You know, this is a picture of a man in a turban on a camel. And that's nice. I'd like to draw that picture of a man in a turban on a camel. And I'd like to make the turban very ornate. And he might draw that, and then some day later he would come up with a caption for it. He used to draw some of these, and he never finished a drawing. The full-color drawings that he did for the Playboy magazine, he never finished it one setting. He'd draw part of it and then color part of it. And then he'd get to a point where he didn't know what color to put on next. So he'd drop the drawing into a a picture frame that he had, and he'd carry it around the house. He sometimes put it up at the foot of the bed at night, and he'd look at it before he went to bed, and as he'd fall asleep, trying to think of what's the next color to put here. How do you do that?
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is cartoon historian, author Bob Harvey, and we're talking a little bit this morning about cartooning, and in part because this is Cartoon Appreciation Week, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Indiana to talk with on our line four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a history question. Yesterday when over the radio you announced that, you know, who your guest was going to be in Cartoon Appreciation Week, I sat down and thought, well, there must be some comic that I may need some information. I didn't know if you could handle that or not. But I think the thing was called The Heap. As I remember, it was an RAF pilot lands in one of the swamps of Florida, something like that, and turns into this huge, sort of vegetable-looking thing, I guess the best way to look at it, and went around saving people's lives and women and everything else. Do you know anything about that by any chance?
Well, yes. You did say The Heap, didn't you?
That's how I, you know, that's what it came to me, and I don't remember if that's true or not, but, you know, I'm saying I'm just picking up, you know, this way back.
Well, it's a very famous comic book character, and
yeah.
You described him perfectly. It was a pilot that landed in a swamp somewhere, and he was presumably killed, but his body sunk to the bottom of the swamp, and the vegetation there sort of attached itself to him. And first thing you knew, it had reanimated the body, and it came up, and it looked like a heap of vegetation.
Yeah.
And he did wander around helping people.
Yeah, he had a strange nose, as I remember, too.
His what?
A strange nose. It was.
Oh, yeah, and his nose looked like some kind of root or something.
Yeah,
it was
root.
Coming out of his head.
Well, I'm sorry to jump in like this, but I thought with your knowledge and stuff, because I've heard you before.
I think it appeared in a comic book called Airboy. Airboy mm-hmm. was the lead feature in the comic book.
Yeah, that just absolutely doesn't, you know, nothing at all. And I've, you know, walked around in comic places when they've had sales and stuff and flipping through, and I've never found it, but I really appreciate it. Makes another good use for WIL contributions, I assure you.
Well, you might be interested to know that the notion of this animated vegetable pile was revived 15 or 20 years ago under the title The Swamp Thing. And Marvel Comics published a whole series of Swamp Thing books.
They do those things, don't they? They get onto something and away they go. I really appreciate it. I want to get off so other people are going to, and you can talk more, because that in some ways is more important to me. But you really took care of a problem I've had for years
All
now.
Right.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Other people will call. If you have questions, you can take advantage of Bob's encyclopedic knowledge of comics and comic books. He knows an awful lot about them and their history, and so questions are certainly welcome. Or if people want to talk about something that they read when they were a kid that they were particularly fond of, you can do that too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
I might mention why this week is called Cartoon Appreciation Week. The National Cartoonist Society they said the first week in May, or rather the week in May from Monday to Sunday, that includes May 5th, would be Cartoon Appreciation Week, and May 5th is Cartoonist Day. And they picked that because on May 5th in 1895, the New York World published a large single-panel cartoon called Hogan's Alley. And in Hogan's Alley, eventually, Hogan's Alley was about a bunch of kids that lived in the Lower East Side or the slums of New York, and one of them was a bald kid who wore a nightshirt, which eventually got to be colored yellow, and he was known as the Yellow Kid. And he was so popular that he was stolen away from the New York World by William Randolph Hearst for his paper, and then the World hired another cartoonist to continue the Yellow Kid's adventures. And so we had two papers fighting for newsstand sales, both of them starring the Yellow Kid. The Yellow Kid was so popular, his picture appeared on the side of the delivery wagons, which led people to speculate about these being the Yellow Kid journals, or the Yellow Journals, or Yellow Journalism.
Mm-hmm.
That's where that expression comes from.
And
because both the papers were experts in sensationalizing the news. Which,
And while that certainly wouldn't have been the first cartoon ever to appear in a newspaper, that's
right.
I gather that people think of that in a sense as being really the first the first modern newspaper cartoon.
That's right. And it falls to the Yellow Kid because he proved that comics in a newspaper improved the commercial viability of the newspaper. It stimulated sales. And once in this country you have proved you could stimulate sales, then you have established a beachhead, and that's what the Yellow Kid did. If it hadn't been him, it would have been somebody else eventually, but we have him to hang the hat on, and that's what made newspaper comics thrive as circulation-building devices.
Mm-hmm. And also one of the things that we know is that of all of the things that appear in the daily newspaper, sometimes the things that people get most exercised about, write letters and call the newspaper about, find controversial, the first thing that they head for in the paper, all of those things are the comics.
That's right.
And I know that the people who work in the editorial departments of a lot of newspapers spend, for them, maybe a disconcerting amount of time dealing with people's comments, complaints, questions that all have to do with what appears on the comic page.
Right. Feature editors who customarily deal with this, they say there are two things that you don't want to do. One of them is change your comics lineup, and the other is make a mistake in the crossword puzzle. Those two things will set readers free faster than just about anything.
Mm-hmm. There must, though, come a time when comics, particularly ones that have been around for a long time, they age out. I would think that depending on your generation, maybe there were certain things that you are in the habit of reading, and it must get to a point where maybe a strip that's been around for a long, long time just isn't as popular anymore. And sooner or later, I would think certain. I think this, for example, about the soap opera strips, like Rex Morgan. I'm not sure why Rex Morgan is or Mary Worth are still around. I guess there are people who do read them.
Well, they're still around because they have very loyal audience, people who tend to be older, of course, who follow these things. You drop Mary Worth, you're going to have a real problem on your hands. And they tend to endure forever. They're called in the trade legacy strips because they generally aren't even done anymore by the people who originated them. The drawing has been passed on to a different artist. The writing is passed on to somebody else. There are a lot of legacy strips who are occupying space in newspapers. Young cartoonists object to them a great deal because they're occupying space that they could get their own comic strip in if it weren't being occupied by this, 50, 60-year-old favorite. The News Gazette tried dropping Prince Valiant a couple years ago, and evidently the protest was so much that they had to reinstate the strip. For a while, it ran on Mondays in black and white in the classified section until they could make a space for it back in the color section of the Sunday Funnies. But that's another perennial favorite, something that has enormous loyalty among its readers.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller on a cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I had a question in regard to graphic novels, comic books, and literacy. When my son was an early reader, one of the things I noticed was that he particularly liked that kind of a transition between what you were talking about earlier with, that word and picture combination. And I thought it actually encouraged him to read more. What I found, though, was when I was looking for graphic novels in particular that were age-appropriate, I was having some difficulty. And I was wondering if you had any suggestion on how to, for other people now. I mean, he's older. He's, moved into his own things. I have another 4-year-old, and kind of just trying to find a source of basically comic books, for young kids. And I'll get off the phone now and just listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think graphic novels, it's going to be hard to find something that's appropriate for a young reader. It's easier to find comic books that are appropriate for a young reader that deal with fantasy worlds and things that are not likely to have adult themes that would be difficult for a kid to understand, and he'd therefore be pestering his mother or his father to explain something to him that maybe they don't want to have to explain just right now. So I guess I would recommend comic books rather than graphic novels. There are an awful lot of graphic novels, and there are there's a whole flood of graphic novels that are produced in Japan called manga, if you go to the Borders bookstore, there's a whole shelf of them. I mean, it goes on both sides of the shelf, probably 50 or 60 feet worth. And they're particularly appealing to teenage girls. So if you have teenage girl readers, why, these are ones that you might be interested in. However, you might want to take a look at them before you put them in the hands of your daughter. Some of them deal with sexual themes in a very sort of casual way. I mean, it's not a big deal in Japan. And you want to take a look at them before you put them in the hands of your children. Again, graphic novels, I don't there are probably some that deal with juvenile matters that young children would be interested in, but I can't offhand think of them. And the big push in recent years with graphic novels has been to deal with adult themes. And by adult, I don't mean sex. I mean things that normal, mature human beings would find interesting, engrossing, engaging, challenging. And these are the kinds of things that 30, 40 years ago you couldn't find in a comic book anymore. Now you can even find comic books that deal with these matters in a much more mature and adult way than they used to 30, 40 years ago.
Is the thing that separates a comic book from the graphic novel more a matter of content than it is of the style of the art?
No, it's really length.
Oh.
If you have a long comic book, you can call it a graphic novel.
I see.
In fact, some people just say that the graphic novel is the long-form comic book. Another distinction, of course, is that the graphic novel tends to deal with more mature subjects. Comic books, there's still a prevalence of superhero adventures in comic books, and you don't find that in graphic novels that much. Graphic novels very often are autobiographical from the cartoonist's point of view. And we're starting to get more and more manga from Japan that are not aimed at teenage girls. In Japan, the manga is an extraordinarily popular art form. They come in books that are the size of telephone books, and people read them at the rate of 15 or 20 pages a second. You know, I mean, they're just flipping pages as fast as you can. And they're produced by teams of artists, just like we would produce animated cartoons in this country. And they're very specialized. There are manga for young girls. There are manga for young boys who like other young boys. There are manga for grown-up men who, in this country, we would call these manga pornographic, I suppose. But there's this whole gamut of specialized interests targeting specific audiences. Most of the stuff in this country is the stuff addressed to young girls. But there are some adventure stories that are available in this country, too, that are just straight-out adventure. They're not there's nothing, no sex in them that I'm aware of. It's just sword and sorcery kind of stuff.
Mm. Has the graphic styles that are popular in Japan in the printed form, the static form, and I'm not thinking so much of anime, of animated cartoons, but of manga, has that become, in a sense, a kind of international style? Have artists all over the place picked up on some of the aspects of Japanese style, and you can now see American comic book artists or French ones, or German ones, or you know, whoever, that are doing things that really echo that kind of style.
The thing, and I'm not really an expert on manga, but the modern flood of manga began in right after World War II, and the man who began it, whose name I can't remember, was impressed with animated cartoons, in particular Betty Boop and Bambi. And you look at the stuff he did, he made a character called Atom Boy or Atomic Boy or something like that. And the character has big round eyes like these animated cartoon characters. And that sort of set the fashion for a long time for the way you drew animated cartoons in Japan and the way you drew manga, which are the comic book versions of whatever's animated. The manga that are produced for young girl readers tend to have characters with very large eyes, large round eyes, and pointed chins and wispy line work and very elaborate hair. Somebody described manga as air comics. What they meant is that they don't have as much plot as they have atmosphere. And you sort of submerge yourself in these things in the same way that you are submerged in the air around you. I think it's probably a decent explanation. But there are also other styles of drawing that are evident in manga. There's a book that just recently arrived here called The Pushman and Other Stories. It's a collection of short stories, but it's drawn in a much different style than the manga that are presently lined up by the hundreds on the bookshelves in Borders and Barnes & Noble. Let's see, and there's another one of the earliest manga to come to this country was called Lone Wolf and Cub or something like that. And it was an adventure story about a samurai character. So it was straight adventure, and yeah. It was not drawn in this big-eyed manner that you very often associate with manga.
And that also was a movie series.
Yes,
with live live actors, and I don't know which came first.
Yeah,
whether
I don't
that either. Was a comic first or was a movie first. Yeah. But I know that there are a series of Japanese movies.
Right, but to get back to your question, which I had forgotten in the excitement of the moment, American cartoonists are now imitating the manga style of drawing. In fact, newspaper syndicates are beginning to try to hitchhike onto the popularity of this manga, and you can now get a syndicated comic called Peach Fuzz, which is available as a Sunday-only comic strip. And it's a manga comic. It's produced by two Americans.
We are a little bit past the midpoint of this part of Focus 580, talking with author and comic historian Robert Harvey. If you're interested in the art of the comic, you can look for some of his books, including The Art of the Funnies, The Art of the Comic Book, Children of the Yellow Kid. He also has a website that has an awful lot of information on comic art on it, which is rcharvey.com. So you can take a look at that. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the things we said we might talk a little bit about is what is going on with editorial cartooning.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it's also something we have talked about in the past. And one of the things I guess one has to say is that it seems to be a kind of a endangered form. Yeah. At least there aren't as many editorial cartoonists as there once were. It seems their numbers shrink all the time.
Yes. Before I talk about that, I'd like to footnote something in response to the woman who called up about looking for things for her young son or young daughter to read. I might mention that this Saturday is called Free Comic Book Day. And if you go to one of the comic book specialty stores, there are two here in Champaign, there's a whole selection of comics that are manufactured expressly for the purpose of acquainting people with what's available in the comic book world, and they're free. You can pick up armloads of these things. Not every comic book in the store is free, but there's a special array of them that have been manufactured expressly for the purpose of acquainting new readers with. This might be a good way to find out what's there that your child might be interested in. Now, to come back to editorial cartooning, recently, last fall, two of the newspapers that are part of the Chicago Tribune Company's chain of newspapers, the Baltimore Sun and the Los Angeles Times, fired their editorial cartoonists who had been there for some years, one of whom at the Los Angeles Times is a Pulitzer Prize winner, fired them ostensibly for budgetary reasons. They simply didn't want to continue paying a salary to somebody when they could get a syndicated editorial cartoon through one of the syndicates for a pittance compared to paying the salary and health benefits and various other things for a full-time staffer. These two positions were eliminated, and both papers announced that they would not be finding that they had discontinued the position. And this has been going on rather slowly for, 10, maybe 15 years. In the editorial cartoonist profession, they say that In the 1980s, there were 200 editorial cartoonists working full-time on American newspapers, and now there are less than 90. That's a slight exaggeration. I would say that in the 1980s, there were 130 full-time staff editorial cartoonists, and now there are about 90. There are a lot of half-time editorial cartoonists, cartoonists who are on the staff in the art department of the newspaper, and they occasionally do editorial cartoons for the newspaper. What's doing the editorial cartoonist in is the whole syndication business. Every editorial cartoonist 40 years ago worked for a paper, did cartoons on national issues, did cartoons on local issues, and then they began to be picked up by syndicates who would distribute the cartoons they did on national issues to a whole list of other client papers. And what this did was, in effect, write the death notice for editorial cartooning. If a newspaper can get a syndicated cartoon on a national issue for very little money, why have a staff cartoonist? Mm-hmm. Well, you have a staff cartoonist in order to draw cartoons about local issues. But local issues make people angry, and they call the editor of the paper, and he has to spend a lot of time pacifying people who are irate. Many editors, in fact, would probably not have to deal with this flood of irate readers who are there chiefly because an editorial cartoonist drew an offensive picture about their sacred cow, whatever it may be. So these two things conspire together to encourage the idea that maybe we don't need a staff editorial cartoonist. Oddly, editorial cartooning as a genre, as a mode of expressing in cartooning, has probably never been as good as it is now. There are a lot of very good editorial cartoonists who work in the visual metaphor mode, which is their stock in trade, to very powerful effect. And a lot of them are syndicated.
Yeah. Oh, I would expect that you talked about the fact that maybe sometimes editors would be disinclined to have staff cartoonists because they would do cartoons on local issues and that would get people angry. I would expect, though, that people still get angry. You know, you put a cartoon in the newspaper that ridicules President Bush or whoever happens to be the president. I'm sure that the same thing happens. A lot of people get angry, and you hear, people don't recall the News Gazette and say, how could you publish that cartoon about President Bush?
Maybe one person would, but if you did it about the mayor of Champaign, you might get 50 or 100 who would call. Editorial cartoonists know this, and so do newspaper editors. They know that local issues are hot-button topics, and if you hit one of them with a cartoon, you're going to get phone calls. And one of the most famous cartoonists in the history of editorial cartoons is Thomas Nast, who was famous for, among other things, creating Santa Claus, the visual image of Santa Claus. But he is also famous for dethroning the corrupt Boss Tweed ring in New York. That's a local issue. It was not a national issue.
All right. Let's talk with someone here, Belgium, nearby. Line 4. Hello.
Hey, yeah, hello. I really miss Bill Mauldin.
Yeah, a lot of people miss Bill Mauldin.
I was just thinking of two cartoons. The first one being, okay, the famous one of the guy shooting the Jeep.
Sitting because where?
Shooting the Jeep. That must have been one of
the... Oh, shooting the Jeep, right. That was
Willie
a World War
Joe,
II cartoon.
His World War II cartoons?
Yeah.
It was I don't know, Jeep, it may have been a lieutenant or something. His Jeep was stalled and he had his pistol out. He was shooting it like a horse.
No. The Jeep had a flat tire.
Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah. And the other one is when Willie and Joe are walking out of this town, and Willie says to Joe, "Yeah, we liberated the hell out of that village."
Yes.
And in the background, there is not a building standing.
Right.
It's all smoking and ruins and stuff. And it's like, yeah, we liberated the hell out of that one.
Yeah, right.
And that, that's timeless. That's actually timeless.
Yes. I'm sure that's right. Mauldin used to get into trouble with...
He got into a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But the people, I'm sure, that servicemen loved...
Oh, yeah,
and
they did.
And loved what he did because they felt like he was really telling it like their experiences
yeah.
were.
Yeah.
It was George Patton who didn't like Malden. He said, men read your cartoons, they look at them, and they think they can get away without shining their shoes. What kind of a guy are you anyway? And Malden, he just said, well, that's how they feel about it. And he won. He never had to give up that way.
Yeah, I don't think hardly any generals liked him, but everyone who was a non-com loved him.
Yes.
Basically.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, very interesting program. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. We have probably about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus with our friend, cartoon historian, author Bob Harvey. If you have questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sort of almost hesitant to mention this, but I think people recall not very long ago the controversy that was started by a European cartoonist who did some cartoons that people felt attacked and disrespected the image of Muhammad.
Right.
And what that certainly does is it serves as an example of just how, you know, an art form that we might trivialize and say, oh, that's nothing very important, can create a great deal of controversy.
Yes.
The thing I was wondering about was, can you think of other examples, another time when a cartoon created that kind of reaction?
No. And the reason, of course, is because the reaction wasn't just to the cartoons. It was 12 different Danish cartoonists who drew cartoons. They were asked by the editor of a Danish newspaper to draw cartoons about Muhammad. And the purpose of the assignment was to examine or to test the extent to which beliefs of Muslims were intimidating the communities in which they lived. And there were instances of this. Writers who had produced writings that were critical of fundamental Islam had been one of them had been murdered, for example. And the immediate spark here was the writer of a children's book who was going to write a biography of the Prophet Muhammad, and he asked somebody to illustrate it, and the person who agreed to illustrate it would do it only on the condition that his name was not ever published, so that because he was afraid of reprisals. Among the most strict Muslims, any representation of the Prophet Muhammad is blasphemy. So there was that to begin with. But the cartoons were published in September, and it wasn't until December or January that there was any big stir about them. Mm-hmm. The Danish Muslim population were upset enough to have a quiet demonstration, but they didn't rampage in the streets or anything. It wasn't until the cartoons were seized upon as a cause célèbre that Islamist fundamental groups could use to advance a political agenda. In my view, the whole episode, it does not illustrate so much the power of cartoons as it does the tremendous cultural gulf that exists between countries in the West and countries, Muslim countries, countries with great populations of Muslims who can't understand us and we can't understand them. There were Muslims who wrote in to various places in connection with this controversy who said something that you might expect one of us to say, which is, why should we expect people who are not Muslims to follow the dictates of the Muslim religion? But there were also people who said, this is a sign of disrespect. It is indicative of just how little people in Western countries, how little respect they have for the Muslim way of life. So it was a very complicated issue. And it was, oddly enough, this came on the horizon in January and February. The firing of these two editorial cartoonists in this country happened in November. So there was this great outcry among the editorial cartoonist profession about the plight of being in a vanishing breed, species threatened with extinction, and then all of a sudden all of Europe and half of the Middle East is afire with people protesting a cartoon. So, as I say, I think it wasn't so much the cartoons. In fact, if you see them, and you can find them on the web, they're really innocuous by Western standards. There are cartoons of George Bush that are more offensive than any of the cartoons here, pictures of Muhammad, at least to the Western mind. Now, to the Muslim mind, it's a different issue, and it's one of those things that we have a very difficult time understanding, just as they have a difficult time understanding us. The Muslim community kept asking the Danish government to apologize for the behavior of their newspaper. Well, the newspapers in Denmark are free, just as they are in this country. So the government didn't feel they had to apologize, or that they could. Mm-hmm. Well, in Mideastern countries, the newspapers are all state-controlled. So the Muslim population said, well, why not? I mean, in their experience, newspapers are creatures of government, so the government ought to take responsibility for them.
Yeah. We have a couple of other people here to talk with in the time that remains. Another Belgium listener here, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, there seems to be two of us, doesn't there? The question I have is, and to get away from the topic of Muslim, is I remember as a child there was a cartoonish strip that was called The Cats and Jammer Kids.
Yes.
And it went along for a long time, and now it's no longer around.
Actually, it is.
What is it?
It is still being published, and it's being drawn by a guy named Hi Eisman, who also draws Popeye.
Oh.
I don't know where it's being printed, but it's still being produced by King Features. The Cats and Jammer Kids started in the 1890s, maybe 1897, by Rudolf Dirks began it. And it was quite a popular strip, and then he went on vacation in the early 1900s. And when he came back, he was hired away by a rival newspaper. He was doing the strip Cats and Jammer Kids for the Hearst newspaper. He was hired by the Pulitzer New York World, and he continued drawing it, and there was a lawsuit. And the lawsuit established that Hearst owned the title The Cats and Jammer Kids, but that Dirks could draw The Cats and Jammer Kids for another newspaper, but he had to have a different title. So it was called Hans and Fritz for a long time, until the World War One, when we decided we wanted to hate everything German, and then we had to change the name of both of the strips. Dirks was called The Captain and the Kids. I don't know what and the Cats and Jammer Kids were, they changed the name for a while. But then after the war, eventually it came back as The Cats and Jammer Kids. Anyway, it's still going.
Oh, because I never see it. I thought it just disappeared.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. There probably are a lot of strips that exist that people never see, depending on where it is. Their newspaper may run a certain number, depending on what you look at, you're going to see what's offered there. There are many more strips that exist probably than most people ever get a chance to see.
And the big syndicates like King, a lot of the circulation of Cats and Jammer Kids is overseas. It's not even in this country. The Phantom, which runs here, has a very low circulation in the United States, but it has a tremendous circulation in other countries.
Really?
Yeah.
All right, let's talk with someone here in Kankakee. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. I had a comment and a question. Comment was on the editorial writers being eliminated, and I'm kind of guessing another angle that the editors are happy to solve a problem of theirs is if you have a staff cartoonist and might be a liberal leaning or conservative leaning, then you're stuck with that type of cartoons every day, and maybe they don't by going to a syndicate, they can pick and choose what they how they want to approach a particular issue each day. That was just kind of something I've been thinking about. But my question is, up in the Milwaukee Art Museum last Saturday opened up a show of comic book artists, and I was wondering what you knew about that and maybe what we can expect when we go up there and check it out.
It's called, I think, the Masters Show, and it originated in Los Angeles. It took place in two museums. One of them was the Modern Art Museum, and they divided this show in half, and about half of the cartoonists on display were classical cartoonists, Winsor McCay's Little Nemo and The Yellow Kid, and things that come out of the early formative years of cartooning through the 1930s, Milton Caniff's Terry and the Pirates and so on, and probably Will Eisner's The Spirit, which was a 30s, 40s creation. The other half of the show were modern contemporary people, including people like Art Spiegelman and Gary Panter and Chris Ware, who are drawing graphic novels now. Mm-hmm. So, and the show treats these things as works of art, not as popular culture. So that's what you would find. It's all under one roof in Milwaukee. The show has been criticized by people on the basis of its canonizing of certain cartoonists to the exclusion of others, most notably women cartoonists. There are no women cartoonists on the walls in this show, and that was the first thing that people were critical of, was the male dominance. And, of course, the fact is that cartooning has been a male, predominantly male field for a long, long, long time. Female cartoonists tended to be rare and few and far between. Still, there were a few that they could have included who were historic figures. One of them, for example, was Edwina Dunn, who drew up in Ohio. She drew, as a teenager, she drew editorial cartoons for Columbus, a newspaper called The Monitor. And she was drawing editorial cartoons on the issues of the day, and it was before women could vote. She eventually gave up editorial cartooning, went to New York, and drew a comic strip for almost 50 years called, now the name is slipping my mind, Stubbs, Captain Stubbs and Tippy. It was about a young boy and his dog, not a feminine-oriented perspective at all. And she kept it up for, as I say, 50 years.
Is there any change in currently in female comic book artists? Is that changing at all?
Or? Oh, yeah. There are a lot more women cartoonists now than there were even 10, 15 years ago. They're starting to get into the field. And
What do you do attribute that?
Well, the emergence of women in almost every field of endeavor.
Mm-hmm. Are there more women reading comics also?
Well, no, they tend to read these manga comics that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. That's a very popular form with young girls. But the women cartoonists, they may have a female following, but it's not exclusive. And there are women cartoonists drawing in newspaper cartoons, too. Kathy is drawn by a woman cartoonist, and the one in the News Gazette, Tina's Groove, is drawn by a woman cartoonist. And, of course, for better or for worse, which is one of the most popular comic strips in the country, is drawn by a woman. In the News Gazette, we also have, what's that called, Best Friends or something like that, which appears immediately above For Better or For Worst, Between Friends. It's also drawn by a woman cartoonist who is also Canadian.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's changing. It's probably not quite as fast as other occupations are changing, but it's changing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, just for the information of anybody who is interested in the show that the caller mentioned, this is at the Milwaukee Art Museum. It's called Masters of American Comics, and we'll be there through the summer, there until August 13th. So if you're interested and you have the opportunity to go. Also, apparently there is a very lavishly illustrated catalog,
yes,
that goes with the exhibition that sounds like it would be a great book if you're interested in comic art. More than 300 color reproductions. And you can, if you're interested in buying one, you could go to the website of the museum. If you have internet access, you could buy it online from them, and I expect that probably be the kind of thing that you could go into a bookstore or buy,
yes,
or have them edit for you. And it's published by the Yale University, mm-hmm, Press. So it sounds like that would be great. If you like comic art, that probably would be a good thing to look at. We're almost at the point here where we've got to wrap up. One thing actually we didn't talk about, you said maybe you might talk a little bit about a strip that you particularly like. One of your current favorites, although it's something that here we can't see because it's not in our...
It's favorite. Called Nine Chickweed Lane. It's an unusual strip in many respects. One of the things unusual about it is that originally the strip was about three women who lived at 9 Chickweed Lane. It was a teenager, her mother, and her grandmother, all of them living there, and it's drawn, written and drawn by a man who women readers say has an uncanny insight into the female mind. It's a very, in recent years, it's become very daring, but the guy who draws it, Brooke McEldowney, very often will draw a picture that is simply amusing in the sense that it is an optical illusion, for example. One of his favorite devices, the young girl in the strip is a ballet dancer, and he will very often show her dancing, and the picture will be of her. She's wearing black leotards, and it is against a black background. So all you see are her arms and legs and her head in some configuration, and you have to figure out what that configuration is. Well, you quickly figure out she's doing some kind of a dance. She recently went to New York and joined a ballet company, and while she was looking for an apartment, she roomed with her male dancing partner, who, it developed, was gay. So from one scandal to another, so to speak. And now she recently, one of her instructors from the Catholic girls' school that she went to, a nun, showed up on the doorstep in mufti. She's given up her order. And then along comes a Catholic priest looking for her. They came very close to holding hands once a couple years ago, and now maybe, well, who knows?
All right. And that is something that you can see. I'm looking at some of the strips here on the web. So, again, if you have access to the Internet, if you put in the name of the strip, 9 Chickweed Lane, you can read it that way.
Right, yeah. All right.
Well, I want to say, Bob, thanks very much.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it.
Our guest, Robert Harvey, his website has a lot of information there about comic art. It's rcharvey.com, and he is also the author of a number of books having to do with comic art. You can head out to the bookstore and find them. And I'm sure on another day he'll come back and we'll talk some more.
I hope so.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.